I'm Peggy Waymeyer, and this is the World Vision Report. Throw down your heart. That's what Africans bound for slavery said when they saw the ocean and realized they were leaving home forever. That's also the name of a new album by banjo master Bela Fleck.
You know, you fall in love with African music and you're going to throw down your heart too.
Slaves brought the banjo to America, and Fleck made an odyssey through Africa to discover its roots. Along the way, he played for people. He thought they'd like bluegrass music best. He was wrong.
Actually, what really blew them away is when I played some Bach. That's the biggest ovation I ever got in a town. They flipped out.
Stone sculptors in Zimbabwe look for customers. And Native Americans on the plains build houses from straw. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Pirates continue to hijack ships off the coast of Somalia. At last count, there were 18 ships and 300 hostages being held. The recent rescue of an American ship and its captain made big headlines. But this isn't a new problem. Pirates have been active in the region for several years, attacking ships carrying everything from oil to food aid. I spoke with Carolyn Herford from the UN World Food Program about the growing problem. When pirates capture a ship full of food aid for people in countries like Somalia and Kenya, what impact does it end up having on the people who are counting on those supplies?
It's absolutely vital, and indeed we're extremely concerned about the fact that with the rise in piracy attacks off Somalia, carrying humanitarian assistance as well as commercial cargoes, if this intensifies, it may lead to millions of people going hungry, not just in Somalia, but also in East and Central Africa. We're talking about 10 million people here who WFP is feeding.
What percentage of the food aid heading to Somalia is transported by ship?
90% of all food which goes to Somalia goes by sea. Therefore, it is absolutely critical that we keep these sea lanes open and we keep the pirates off, because otherwise we can't use the overland routes. It's too dangerous with all the bandits and general conflict situation which we encounter in Somalia. So it absolutely has to be through sea and shipping to Somalia that we can get any food to the 3.5 million people that we're trying to distribute to there.
So there really aren't any other efficient or cost-effective ways to get food into these countries other than by ship?
Exactly. I mean, it just is the most cost-effective means of bringing in food into this particular region, other than that food which we can purchase locally. But then we have to be extremely careful, of course, not to allow the markets to put the prices of the food beyond the reach of those who are able to buy it themselves. If WFP comes into the equation and the prices go through the roof, then most of the locals wouldn't be able to buy the food. So it's a very fine balancing act to maintain. We want to help the local farmers. We want to assist them in any way that we can to keep the markets going. But at the same time, we are aware that when we're talking about huge numbers of people, like, as I said, 10 million people in the region needing food assistance, we obviously have to bring in large quantities of food assistance from elsewhere.
Caroline, the piracy problem isn't new, even though this dramatic hijacking of an American ship brought it to the attention of many Americans for the first time. Your ships have been struggling with pirates for several years, and one of the ways the UN has handled this is to use naval escorts for its ships. How has that worked?
It's worked extremely well. First of all, were the French Navy, then it was taken over by the Dutch and Canadian navies. It all began at the end of November 2007. And we can solemnly say that any ship that has been escorted by a naval vessel has not been attacked by pirates. We feel that we've got a very good chance of reaching the hungry, particularly in Somalia, through the use of these naval escorts. It's critical to our success.
Okay, so if you've been using naval escorts and you continue to do that, what is the risk? It seems as though the food will get to people. What threat really are the pirates to food aid then?
Well, essentially, the Maersk Alabama was part of the cargo, was 232 containers of food for the World Food Program. That ship was also carrying food for other agencies. And so was not being escorted because it was really not up to the World Food Programme to ensure the safety of that ship's arrival. But it would have been a critical loss if we hadn't been able to receive that food and then transport it to Somalia.
So are you saying that there are many other ships that carry your food plus others' food that are threatened and will affect your delivery of aid?
Yes, potentially. I mean, we're constantly looking at ways of getting food to the hungry. And essentially, for those ships that we are responsible for chartering, we have to try to ensure naval escorts. For the other people who supply us with our food assistance that we need, because you must understand that there is a huge quantity of food which is required for 10 million people in this region, that is up to the owners and charterers of those ships. But clearly it would have an effect on our beneficiaries when they are expecting to receive the food either in Mombasa or in Mogadishu. And if it doesn't come because of piracy, then we have a problem.
Caroline Herford with the UN World Food Programme, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
President Obama recently announced a loosening of restrictions on travel to Cuba. That could be good news for Cubans who rent out rooms or run small restaurants. Those are the only two types of free enterprise allowed in Cuba right now. But these businesses are strictly regulated and taxed at more than 80%. So some Cubans are skirting the government and trying to make a little extra money on the side, or a la izquierda, as Cubans say. Amelia de Souza reports from Trinidad. The names of the people in her story have been changed to protect their identities.
Germán Peña is in his backyard with a couple of friends lifting weights. Like most things in Cuba, gym equipment is hard to find, so Peña and his friends have gotten pretty creative at improvising. Some of them drag over a heavy set of rusted, round metal plates, which they stack onto a bar.
These are just hunks of iron, really, the gears from big trucks. We use them to lift weights because exercise is good for our health.
What Peña is afraid to say in the microphone is that it's also good for his wallet. He's running this makeshift gym as a small, illegal business. As one of the guys labors to bench press about 200 pounds in car gears, another counts his repetitions using pebbles on the ground. The guy on the bench says he's going to do a set of 20, but he only makes it to 17. Peña charges 20 Cuban pesos per month, less than a dollar, to use this equipment. He's got about 10 regular customers, all friends in the neighborhood. Peña, like all Cubans, gets a monthly government stipend of about 15 U.S. dollars. He also gets a monthly ration book for basic food, and he doesn't have to pay rent. In his day job, he's a jack of all trades.
Bueno, yo lo mismo soy ayudante albañil que cocinero.
Sometimes I work in construction, sometimes I'm a cook, or a carpenter, whatever I need to make a living. I've run this place in my house for a few years, but because working conditions here are so bad...
By working conditions, he means that what the government pays him isn't enough to get by, hence his backyard business. But other people make their illegal money right on the street.
Buenas tardes, amigo. ¿Dónde usted tiene un hotel acá?
This tourist has just driven into Trinidad. He rolls down the window to ask a guy on the street where he can find a hotel. Jesus Romero has been working this corner at the entrance to town for years. He works as a jinetero, which is Cuban slang for a guy who hunts for tourists. He waits for tourists to ask for directions, then offers to work for them as a guide. Romero crouches in the back seat to avoid being seen by police and at the same time points out the local tourist attractions, the church, the town square. It's illegal for him to be talking to tourists, much less riding in their car. But he does it to compensate for the meager government salary he earns working as a school teacher.
Me pagan un dinerito.
I make only a little money, about 300 Cuban pesos, which is about 15 convertible pesos.
Convertible pesos, that's Cuba's second currency. The first, of course, is the Cuban peso, which is worth next to nothing. The convertible peso, or CUC, is only for tourists. It's pegged to the U.S. dollar and is designed to generate profits from tourism for the government. It's illegal for Cubans to have CUCs, but tour guides like Romero are specialists at working foreigners for CUC tips, which they then convert on the black market into Cuban pesos.
I have to invent ways to make money without stealing. That's why I go with tourists. I help them find a place to sleep, or bring them to a family restaurant, or take them horseback riding.
He never asks for money, but instead waits patiently for a tip at the end of his services. Most tourists are pretty generous. On a good day, he can make $10, nearly what he makes in a month at his teaching job.
Everybody is doing something outside of their job to make a little money, because if we don't, we'll die of hunger. We won't have enough to eat.
At an intersection, a policeman stops the car and asks Romero where he's going. Romero says he's just helping these people who got lost find their way back to their hotel. The policeman stares at him, then waves the car on. This time, Romero was lucky.
Oh boy, I am running a big risk here, too big. Because if the police see me, they can arrest me. I can get up to 4 years behind bars.
And the more money you make, the bigger the crime. Roberto Alvarez knows. He used to take tourists on illegal scuba diving trips for $50 a pop, until he was caught.
They'll take you to this place without windows. You don't know if it's night or day. They don't give you enough to eat. They wake you up when you're sleeping in your cell at 2 in the morning to interrogate you. They want to know who you are with, where, when. They hit you to make you talk. They attack you with a dog with no teeth, just to scare you.
After his ordeal in the jail, Alvarez was sentenced to 4 years of house arrest, a common punishment for petty crimes. But he says if given the chance, he'll go back to the illegal scuba diving business, because he says to survive in Cuba with a family, you've got to work a la izquierda, or on the side. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia De Souza in Trinidad, Cuba.
There's a slideshow to go with this story. You can find it on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And you can read Amelia's blog there as well. You're listening to a song that's popular in Cuba right now. It's called Mujeres, and it's by Eddie Kay, a reggaeton group from Cuba. Never heard of reggaeton? Well, it's a mix of reggae, hip-hop, and salsa. And this is what it sounds like. Coming up, musician Bela Fleck takes the banjo back to its birthplace in Africa. We'll hear the story and the music ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. We talked earlier in the show about Somali pirates seizing ships with food aid. Somalia is considered by many a failed state, volatile and dangerous. So it's somewhat surprising that Somali land, right next door, is a beacon of peace and stability in the region. Somaliland seceded from the larger Somalia in 1991, but a lack of international recognition means Somaliland can't get loans from the international community. And that, say Somalilanders, is hindering their country's development. Perhaps there's no starker example of that than in the country's largest hospital, in the capital, Hargeisa. Richard Locke has this reporter's notebook.
Dr. Farhan Omar looks every part the doctor. He wears a spotless, starched white coat and pressed black trousers. A stethoscope hangs around his neck. He has a kind face and gentle demeanor, but his immaculate appearance and soft touch seem to me incongruous with his surroundings at the Hargeisa General Hospital. The pediatric ward is in a pitiful condition. The plasterboard ceiling is caving in. An oxygen cylinder lies discarded in the corner of the ward, covered in dust. It's the pediatric ward's only source of oxygen, but its delivery system doesn't work. Everything from equipment to drugs is in short supply here. Dr. Farhan tells me the only thing in abundance are patients.
It's 21 pairs. They are not enough. So sometimes we
have 21 beds here, but it's not enough. Sometimes we have to put extra beds outside, and then it rains.
Dr. Farhan leads me over to the bedside of a young girl. Her face is gaunt and her arms are pencil thin. Her mother lifts up her bedclothes to reveal two skeletal legs covered in scabs and sores. She looks no older than 18 months, but Dr. Farhan tells me she's 3. The little girl lies listless on the bed. Her mother's dark brown eyes appeal for help.
This child is from a far village, from here. So
this child's from a faraway village. She came in with pneumonia, but on top of this, she has acute malnourishment. Her hair has turned white. She's a typical case of severe protein deficiency.
It should be easy to help this little girl, I learn. All she needs is some specially formulated supplement. But there isn't any here. In fact, there isn't any in the whole of Somaliland. So Dr. Farhan is trying to make his own out of oil, sugar, and milk. Her case should be simple, he says. But Dr. Farhan can't promise her parents she'll make it. I shouldn't be surprised by these dire working conditions. This year, Somaliland's Ministry of Health will receive less than $1 million out of the government's budget. $1 million is what Britain spends on healthcare every 5 minutes. It's a depressing statistic. But Dr. Farhan himself is reason for cautious optimism. Last year, he graduated from a new medical school in the nearby city of Borama. He and his 15 fellow students were the first locally trained doctors in years. He receives a government salary of just $65 a month. The British government tops this up with an additional $450 as part of a program to keep Somaliland's doctors from emigrating to the West. Outside the ward, we walk across blood-spattered paving stones. The fading stains look like they've been there a while. Dr. Farhan politely excuses himself and hurries off. He's the only doctor on duty today in the pediatric ward, and he has other young lives to save.
Richard Locke is a reporter based in East Africa. Bela Fleck is probably one of the best-known banjo players in the country. He fits comfortably into the niche of American bluegrass, maybe with a bit of jazz thrown in here or there. But a couple of years ago, Bela Fleck decided to take his banjo and head to Africa, where the banjo originated. Fleck visited 4 countries, Mali, Tanzania, Uganda, and the Gambia. He traveled to big towns and tiny villages, playing the banjo with local musicians wherever he could. The journey's been captured in a documentary and CD coming out this month. It's called Throw Down Your Heart. Bela Fleck joins us from his home in Nashville. Bela Fleck, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you traveled across Africa on this journey of discovery. What inspired you in the first place to do this?
Well, a big part of it has to do with the fact that the banjo is from Africa. And since the banjo is such a big part of my life, I just wanted to know more about it.
What did you learn about the banjo in its development?
Well, it was just good to see banjos in different parts of West Africa and see how natural it was and how it fit into the environment. Because there's like the akanting in the Gambia, which is the banjo-like instrument there. And there's the ngoni in Mali. And so there's a lot of diversity and a lot of funky, cool music.
Let's talk about the akanting, the banjo in Gambia, where you went first. What does it look like?
Yeah, it's made from a calabash, which is a big gourd, and it's got a skin head over the top of it. And then it's made with 3 strings rather than 5, so that's different. It's a muddy, earthy sound. It sounds so cool.
And you had a great time playing along with musicians playing the akanting, and maybe we can listen to a piece where we can hear you playing the banjo and the akanting also playing with you. A little bit about how the banjo got from Africa to the United States, and it's connected a little bit to the title of your new album and documentary, which is Throw Down Your Heart. Tell us
right.
A little bit about that title and the banjo.
Well, the banjo came to the United States from West Africa with slaves, and there's a lot of popular lore in the Gambia where they talk about the fact that some of the early trips Most of the slaves died on the way to the New World, but eventually they started letting them bring along some instruments, and they say it was the accounting, and that by having the music played on the ships that a lot more people survived. In East Africa, we heard a different story of all the slaves that went east to the Arab countries. And there's a town in Bagamoyo. It's called Bagamoyo. And the literal translation is throw down your heart. And this is the town where the slaves were taken from. They were processed through this town. And when they saw the ocean, they knew they'd never see their homes again, and they threw down their heart. So it's kind of a downer as a title, but there's something powerful about this image. And I like titles that can be seen a lot of different ways. If, you know, you fall in love with African music and you're going to throw down your heart too. It can be seen a lot of different ways, but the dark undertone of it is that it is, you can't separate it from the slaves. It's part of that whole history.
We do see you in the documentary playing in a lot of villages and open air jam sessions. One of the ones I like best was, I believe it was in Uganda, where the men were playing on this handmade marimba, and all these different people playing. It seemed almost impromptu, and there you were on your banjo joining them. Describe the marimba. It was really an interesting instrument.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is amazing. Now, when you talk about a marimba, there can be all different sizes of a marimba. But in Uganda, in this town, Nakasenyi, they have a giant marimba that it takes 8 people to play. And they dig a big hole in the ground and build this instrument on top of it. Each key of the marimba would be like the size of a stair step. And so imagine about 15 or so of those end on end. And it shakes the ground when they play. It's such a powerful sound.
Well, let's play this clip from the village in Uganda with all the other instruments. What was that experience like for you when you were playing in that village with those people?
Well, it was kind of like being in shock the whole time, because first of all, the instrument never stops surprising you, the instrument that they're playing. And then the sense of playing with a whole, I mean, I don't think I've ever played with so many people at once. I mean, there must have been 25 or 30 people all playing at once. I can't ever remember doing that.
And these weren't all professional musicians. Music is woven into their everyday life. The women are singing when they're doing the washing, the children are singing and dancing. What did you learn or see about the role of music in their lives there?
In these places that were cherry-picked for their musical heritage and musical, all the great music that's happening in that area, you could see it. And there's a tendency to want to imagine that as being, you know, unique to them. But when I think about it, there are certain places in the United States where that's true, you know, certain parts of North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky. There are places like that in Ireland where the kids are learning the fiddle music from their parents and it's taught early. But these kids are just soaking it up. And it's amazing because, you know, you see a little kid and he wants to play too.
And you didn't just play with them. You appeared to make some fast friends in that village. And you looked sad when it was time to leave.
Well, it was amazing. I mean, we camped out in the village, just outside of the town square, you know, maybe like a city block away in a field, because I got to wake up every morning at the campsite and sit, you know, get up and drink coffee, and the villagers would come by and hang out, and the kids would watch me from behind rocks and stuff. I just felt really connected to that place by the end of a week there.
Yeah. Now, even though your banjo comes from Africa, many of the people there had never seen a banjo like yours. How did they react when you pulled it out and started playing with them?
Well, there was a good bit of puzzlement. I expected a more universal excitement when they heard the music of Earl Scruggs, which is what I figured would really knock them out, the bluegrass banjo stuff. But actually what really blew them away is when I played some Bach.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. That's the biggest ovation I ever got in a town when I pulled out my banjo. Because inevitably we would end up in a new place. We'd be meeting the town fathers or whoever, and the musicians would be there with their instruments out, and they'd play something for me, and then I'd play something for them, and I'd have to think of something to play. What am I going to play in this situation?
Well, is this what you played for them?
Yeah.
What kind of response did you get when you played Bach on the banjo?
They flipped out. And I don't understand why. I mean, again, it was a suggestion of one of the crew guys. And I never would have thought of it, but it definitely opened up a lot. It was surprising.
Now, Bela, when you moved on with your banjo to Tanzania, you came across some young people from the Maasai tribe. How did their music compare with music in the other places you visited?
Oh, the Maasai music was like nothing I'd ever heard. But I loved it. It was very guttural and rhythmic. And, you know, I was hoping to find some things like this that would just be so different, so almost alien, that I could get recorded and play along with.
In the documentary, when we see you with them in the evening, it's almost like they go into a trance.
Yeah, you can see their eyes are sort of going really rapidly up and down, and they look spaced out, but they're producing some amazing sounds.
Okay, now, I have to admit, Bela, I wouldn't think that music would appeal to everybody.
Right. I had a number of people that suggested we drop it from the film. But, you know, this was supposed to be an adventure. And that's some adventurous music.
What did you like about the music we just heard?
It's funky. It's funky.
It is funky.
Yeah, I liked it. It's rhythmic. It's weird. It's an expression of humanity. I mean, these are kids. I mean, these are the Maasai do their music when they're in their teens, but when they get to a certain age, they don't do it anymore. So when you see what they're doing and the sound of it, I like all kinds of crazy stuff. To me, it was just a great sound.
And I was watching you in that documentary. When they're singing and doing this dancing, you just blend right in with your banjo. How do you do that?
That's a good question, and it's actually the question that's the hardest for me to answer. I can tell you when I practice on something, but a lot of times I just am forced to jump into things with no preparation, not knowing what it's going to be. And a lot of times I do really well in those situations, and I can't exactly tell you why or how. I don't know. It's the unconscious part of me.
Yeah, it must be the unconscious part. And music seems to transcend so much. In fact, you didn't speak the same language as a lot of these people, but once you all start playing, it's as though language doesn't matter.
It's a curious thing. I mean, you could also realize that there is a language being spoken, and that there's a language in music, and that the, you know, rhythm is part of the language and pitch is part of the language, and that we can have a lot of conversation within the music with no words.
On the last leg of your journey, you were in Mali, a country that many consider the crown jewel of the music community in Africa. Why is that?
The musicians in Mali are very well recorded and they're almost like jazz musicians. And there's a lot of very famous musicians from that part of the world. Probably more musicians from Mali are sort of superstars in the world music community than in any other part of Africa.
And you have quite a bit on your documentary with you and Umu Sangare, who's called the Songbird of Wasulu. Tell me a little bit about her.
Yeah, no, she's a superstar, but she's very gracious. She takes care of poor people. There's an orphanage that she's in charge of. She's a fighter for women's rights in Africa and around the world, and you know, just an all-around good person who happens to be super talented.
What makes her singing so special?
That's one of those indefinable things, but there's a magic to her sound, and every once in a while, you hear something so rooted and so just—it just sounds right. That there's something that makes you just feel good about being a human being when you hear it, and I feel that way about her singing.
The two of you performed a ballad together, which is both in the documentary and on the album. So let's listen to a bit of that. Bela, what is she singing about in that song? It's very haunting.
Oh, well, I think she's singing about children that are, you know, are left alone, and the lonely songbird sings in the forest, sort of different things like that.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it really is.
Bela, I heard this documentary was kind of a family affair. It wasn't just your idea. Your brother went with you.
That's correct. My brother's name is Sasha Palladino, and he's the director of the film. And it was a team effort between Sasha and I. We didn't get to know each other very well as kids because he was born the year I left to start my music career, so I would only see him once in a while. But this was the first thing we did together, a major project we've done together, and it was kind of a way for us to get to know each other. And I think he did an incredible job directing the film.
Yeah, he really did. I'm wondering how your trip across Africa has influenced your music now, if at all. What difference did it make into how you're playing today and writing music?
Well, I always tell people that if they want to become good at a certain type of music, they should listen to it all the time for years. And so I listened to African music for a good solid year intently before I went to Africa. And ever since I got back, I've been editing and mixing this music for a good 3 years, the film and the music. And so I've been living with this music every day for 5 years now, and it does work its way inside of you, and it gives you different feelings about what makes a good song, what makes good music. But now when I play, like for instance, we just finished our first tour with African musicians, and it was a gas. We had four musicians from different countries, and at the end of that, I felt even more in tune to, you know, how I play different and how I want to write differently.
Well, why don't we go out then on the title song, Throw Down Your Heart?
Sure.
Anything you want to tell us about that song before we play it?
This happened in Mali, and I had written the tune on the way to Africa in a layover, and I took out my banjo, as I often do when I'm sitting in airports with nothing to do and just fooling around. This tune just fell out into my hands. And then I was looking for people to play this tune with all on my whole trip, and it wasn't until I got to Mali that I found the right guys. Haruna Samake on Camel Ngoni, and Baseko Kuyate playing the Malian banjo, which is called the Ngoni.
Well, let's listen. Bela Fleck, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for joining us today on the show.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
You can see video of Bela Fleck in Africa on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, for hundreds of years, the Shona people in Zimbabwe have sculpted images out of stone, but the economic crisis in the country is affecting that tradition. We'll hear from Zimbabwe after the break. Stay with the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Zimbabwe has become known for many things in recent years: spiraling poverty and hunger, questionable elections, and out-of-control inflation. But long before the current crisis, Zimbabwe was known for its art, specifically its Shona sculpture. The sculpture can be seen all over the world in art galleries, museums, and parks. Depending on their size and their maker, these pieces bring in up to $10,000. But the sculptors who make the pieces are going through very difficult times right now. Tendai Maposa has this report.
Many cars and pedestrians pass by one of Harare's roadside craft markets, but few people stop to go inside. The market is full of mostly small sculptures made from stones that were once worthless pieces of rock. There's verdite, springstone, soapstone, opal, dolomite, and leopard rock. The stones have been carved, polished, and lined up neatly for customers to see. The pieces depict heads, couples, families, and wild animals in shades of green, red, and white, and many other colors. Behind the market, Fungai Tsumba is hunched over a piece of stone on the ground. With a hammer and chisel, he is creating another piece to join the others. Every so often, he looks up in hope rather than expectation that a passerby will stop to look or even buy. The market used to draw many customers, he says, but the tourists who made up the majority of them have all but vanished, thanks to Zimbabwe's political turmoil and economic disintegration. Tsumba says the lack of customers sometimes forces him to sell his pieces at a price way below what he expected for them just so he can pay for life's necessities. He says for him sometimes it's a question of just earning the bus fare home.
Sometimes you get one customer a month, sometimes two a month. So you'll be forced to sell a piece, even a dollar. There's no option.
Tsumba has been sculpting for the past 15 years. He says the economic situation is so bad now that a lot of his fellow artists have left the country for neighboring South Africa. Some have even gone overseas. He says that's not an option for him since he can't even afford to get a passport. Meanwhile, on the other side of town, David Shidumo is waiting for customers too. He's the curator at the Chapungu Sculpture Park, an open-air gallery where the work of some of the country's best-known artists is displayed for sale. Some of the sculptures depicting people and animals here are so expressive, you'd think they'd start moving all by themselves. Shidumo says sculptors used to live well from the sale of their pieces, but that was before the tourists disappeared.
Artists, they were able to buy houses, they were able to do whatever they want, you know. They were able to send their children to school, but now they can hardly find any food to eat to feed their children because nobody's coming.
One of the artists whose work is displayed here is Taylor Nkomo. Despite the slump in business, he is still busy producing beautiful pieces of art. He stands in front of one of them.
This is a sculpture depicting motherly love. That's a mother playing with a child. You can see that they are really together. And the stone is spring stone, which is one of the hardest stones around. So it has taken me about 3 months to finish this sculpture.
Back at the roadside craft market, Fungai Tsumba, whose father was also a sculptor, isn't ready to quit just yet. In fact, he's already teaching his young children how to sculpt.
I have to maintain it nicely, teaching my kids, even anyone who is willing to come, he can come, I will teach him for free.
The word Zimbabwe actually means big house of stone in Shona, and artifacts have been found at a UNESCO World Heritage site here, proving that stone sculpting is a skill that stretches back more than 10 centuries. And it's artists like Tsumba who, despite the odds, are helping to keep the Shona stone sculpting tradition alive. For the World Vision Report, I'm Tendai Maposa in Harare, Zimbabwe.
There are photos of Shona sculpture on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Regandi fare inguva yacho, regandi tambe ndiyo nguva yangu.
For most of us, harsh winters are unpleasant, but almost never life-threatening. So Robert Young was shocked by a newspaper article he read while on a business trip to New Mexico. It described how several elderly people had frozen to death on a local Indian reservation. The story turned the life of the successful Seattle businessman upside down.
I was in Taos, New Mexico, having breakfast before meeting, and I happened to read an article in Indian Country Today. And the headlines were that several more Native people, mainly elderly, had froze to death on the Pine Ridge Reservation and other reservations in the Northern Plains. It shocked me that this could happen. I was not hearing about it on CNN, my local newspaper, or anywhere else. And yet it was happening, as a newspaper saying, almost every year. But for some reason, I kept the newspaper and I wanted to find out more.
How long did you carry that around with you before you decided to jump in and do something?
Too long, way too long. I actually came back to Seattle. I'm not a builder. I had a clothing company and had no experience in construction. I've never met a Native person, never been on a reservation. And my lack of understanding was enormous, to say the least. I don't understand why I chose this or why it chose me, but I knew that there would obviously have to be other groups out there doing something about it, but it really didn't find anything that really hit home with me.
And when you first got involved, you read the article, you carried it around, you talked to friends, but you met a woman on a reservation who really had an impact on you. Tell me a little about Catherine Redfeather.
I happened to read something similar about the plight of Pine Ridge Reservation, and that a woman was trying to get what she called the adopt-a-grandparent program going on that reservation. And it was what I liked about it wasn't just something that you wrote a check to. It was almost a pen pal, and I could find out from somebody on the ground really what was happening and what her circumstance was. And we began to write back and forth.
You adopted her as a grandmother?
I adopted Catherine Redfeather.
Mm. How old was she?
She was 75.
And you went to visit her?
I did. When I saw in her living situation was a situation that you would never want your own grandparents to live in. At the time, I was fairly new out of college and newly married as well. And I knew what I wanted in my life, and it was completely self-absorbed. But what I saw on the reservation really started to change me.
What was Catherine's house like? What did you see that really turned you around?
Well, Catherine lived in a trailer that basically you would drag behind your truck or car. And she had no running water. She shared an outhouse with multiple other families. And they had a flag, and this is something that has never left my mind. She had a flag, a black flag, above the outhouse. And she goes, it's there to keep the rattlesnakes away, because they think it's a bird, a hawk or an eagle coming in to get them, so they don't come too near the outhouse. Catherine was one situation, and when I looked at her community, it was multiply that by thousands. And so after meeting her and getting to know her family for a while, I came back to Seattle and said, I've seen this. This is what I want to do, and I need your help. And I started talking to people all over the place.
So you developed Red Feather Development Group. And this first house was for your adopted grandmother, Catherine, right?
It was, but after building the home, and Catherine had mentioned, you've seen what the need is here, and how do we do more of this? And so we looked at it as a way that, not only are we building homes, but we're looking at a cultural exchange that often doesn't take place on the reservations.
The Native Americans actually pay for the materials, and then you bring in a group of volunteers to build their houses?
Yeah, we help them work with lenders that will supply a low-income, low-interest loan. And then we work with them as an organization to purchase the needed materials, design the home, and then work together as a community, as a family, to build the home.
So if I were to go onto one of these reservations and saw one of the houses, what would it look like?
Now we're really focused on how can we do this using materials that the community has on the ground. And if you look at reservations in the Northern Plains and throughout the western area of the United States, a tremendous amount of wheat is being grown on the reservations. And when we look at the wheat fields after it's been harvested and all the straw that's out there, we really start asking ourselves, how can we use this as a construction material? And fortunately, straw bale construction has been around for well over a century. So we adopted straw bale construction. And when we started teaching communities about how they can do this on their own, our program took a really fundamental twist and turn in the way that we're looking at how to address this housing issue. We knew as a small organization that we could not solve this problem without providing the tools and technology to the communities so that they can do this on their own.
How do you build a house out of straw bales?
Think about adult Legos, big blocks of straw. You stack them up like bricks. We teach a method called load bearing. We don't do any framing, no infill with straw on the walls. The straw itself, laid in a brick-like fashion, is really the walls. That's what's bearing all the roof weight. You cover it with stucco, and when you're done, you really have a beautiful, thick-walled, adobe-style home that is incredibly well insulated.
You must get an incredible response from the people, and I would think that'd be pretty satisfying.
It is. It's it's one of the things that led me to sell my company and take this on full time. And my wife left her company, and we moved our entire family from Bellevue, Washington, just outside of Seattle, to Bozeman, Montana, to be closer to some of the communities we're working with. There's ups and downs. Believe me, this work is oftentimes incredibly difficult, and probably more important than the house itself is the outcome of a project. A family gets to move into a new home. They become much more stable than they've ever been in their lives. They know where they're going to feed their children that day. They can begin to start looking at the other concerns that address not only themselves, but their nations. And it's that ripple effect and the cultural exchange that we see is much more valuable than the house itself.
Robert Young, founder of Red Feather Development, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Here now is our Globe at a Glance. The race between CNN and actor Ashton Kutcher to get 1 million followers on Twitter might have been a publicity stunt, but nobody seems to be complaining. That's because it was all for a good cause. Whoever reached the goal first promised to donate $100,000 to the group Malaria No More. The organization's goal is to eradicate malaria by 2015. Right now, the mosquito-borne disease kills a child every 30 seconds in Africa. A simple bed net could help to save those lives, and the group sends thousands of them to Africa every year. So who won the battle of the tweets? Ashton Kutcher. And his donation to Malaria No More was matched by CNN. So at $10 apiece, that's 20,000 bed nets heading for Africa. And that's our Globe at a Glance. Malaria is found mostly in Africa and Asia, but one of our reporters got malaria on a trip to Honduras. Will Everett tells us about it in this reporter's notebook.
It started as a headache that wouldn't go away, then chills and a foul-smelling sweat. This was something more than the flu, my family doctor said, since he'd found blood in my urine, so he put me in the hospital. They thought it was meningitis, but three spinal taps showed nothing. My T-cell count had fallen to zero, and the internists assumed it must be AIDS, so they put me in quarantine. Somehow no one made the connection between this freak sickness and the trip I'd made to Honduras only 2 weeks before. By the time the test results came back showing Plasmodium falciparum, the malaria parasite, in my blood, I had a 105-degree fever and was screaming from hallucinations. My best friend and I went to Honduras to see the northernmost edge of the Central American rainforest belt and visit a mahogany plantation. When I'd been there before, I'd always taken my anti-malaria medicine, but this was just going to be a one-week trip, so why bother? This was 1995, around the time when bizarre new drug-resistant strains of the virus were just coming on the scene. The hospital internist told me that even if I'd taken preventative drugs, it probably wouldn't have helped. People who experience malaria describe it as a living nightmare. The hallucinations were an eerie combination of horror movie monsters and fire and brimstone sermons. Satan versus Godzilla. But even a nightmare has its gentle moments. Woven into this terrifying movie were shimmering women in Victorian costumes who'd approach the hospital bed and beckon me to dance. The nurse said when I wasn't screaming, I was filling the corridor with a demented laughter. She wasn't sure which was worse. The hallucinations, the ice baths, the faces of weeping family members at my bedside, it's all mostly a blur. But one day the fever broke. The virus went into retreat, and I found that I could at last form a coherent thought. And that thought was, it's good to be alive. And what was clear from the nurses, doctors, and one dour priest who'd participated in my battle was that no one really thought I was going to make it. 13 years later, I found myself in a Pakistani hospital reporting on polio. I walked past a ward devoted to malaria patients. The shouts and moans coming from that ward were familiar. But these patients weren't connected to IVs and sophisticated monitoring devices. They were lying in their own sweat, waiting for their medicine to kick in, waiting for life or death, and caught in that strange limbo of hallucination that I remembered so well. And once again, I found that it was good to be alive.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter and producer living in Texas.
Can you put your hand together, everybody?
And we'll leave you today with music from Senegalese singer Youssou N'Dour. The award-winning singer has taken on the fight against malaria. In 2005, he held a concert called Roll Back Malaria in Senegal. He invited singers from around the world to perform. Yes. Lindor has been invited to the White House as well as to the G8 meeting, where he urged world leaders to join him in the fight against malaria.
The message is moral. It's moral because of we can be a leader like President of the United States or a member of the G8 and to see a lot of kids suffering, dying. And I tell them also, this is the only war, the leaders can win. And they have to win this war against malaria.
We highlight World Malaria Day on our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can see photos, video, and link to our special on the fight against malaria.
Everybody!
This program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber, Christina Darden, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
They will not be ignored.